Welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station. We are KYMN Radio, 1080 on your AM dial, and of course, 50 years starting September 27th. And we are also the 195.1 FM. Oh, what a beautiful morning. I got up so early this morning, I watched the sunrise. It was just fantastic. And listening to all of the birds chirping, I saw a couple of cardinals in the backyard yesterday. I put out a flower basket and a hummingbird feeder. And last year I was late in doing that, and I didn't attract hummingbirds that have been around our house for 20 years. And I hope they find us again, because it's always fun to actually sit there in the quiet and listen to them. You can actually hear their wings fluttering and watch them. It's always a lot of fun. Well, speaking about fun, tomorrow night's a big night in Northfield for many reasons, and I'll give you one because you are invited to come to the Grand Event Center tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock, social hour, and then at 6 o'clock, a very short program recognizing Vanessa Gonzalez, who is the reigning Minneapolis Aquatennial Queen of the Lakes, and that is a big deal, ladies and gentlemen. The young lady gets to network all over the United States and even into Canada. And funny as it is, the year before, Carolyn Myers won that opportunity to expand her scholarship monies through the Minneapolis Aquatennial after being the defeated Jesse James Day's ambassador. And that's never happened in the somewhat 80-year history of the Aquatennial that one community had two Queen of the Lake representatives in a row. That's never happened before. So there's a reception for Vanessa tomorrow evening at the Grand Event Center. You are invited. 5 to 6 is going to be a social hour, and at 6 o'clock, a small program. It's always a lot of fun, and she's been representing you, Northfield, and of course, the defeat of Jesse James Days for almost a year now, and that's a lot of work, and it's a great opportunity to get the word out to many places like the Rose Bowl, San Antonio, Canada, Mexico, wherever else they go, and talk about Northfield and the defeat of Jesse James Days. Well, I have a guest who is returning. He was here last Friday when we chit-chatted about something, and I asked him to come back because he is in a business I've always wanted to know about. So I'm going to take this opportunity right now to welcome my guest this morning, Chris Sorensen. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Wayne. How are you?
I'm fine. You are such a laid-back guy. Did anybody ever tell you that?
Yeah, people have told me that before, yeah.
And that's good. Mm-hmm. In your profession, you are an attorney.
I am.
And we're going to talk about it because I've always wanted to learn about patents, and you are an expert in that area. But first of all, you wanted an opportunity to correct yourself from last Friday's show in regards to the proposed Northfield Ice Arena. So take all the time you want.
Yeah, you know, you had asked a question. I think we were talking about the proposal that's before the city council staff members trying to understand the amount of revenue that we need to earn or raise in order to build the two-sheet community arena. And you know, the $21 million is the estimated cost for the total arena. And I think there was a question about I was trying to make a point that it's not the full $21 million that needs to be raised through tax revenue, either the half-cent sales tax or the property referendum. And I looked at my notes and I looked at the wrong number. So it's for the $21 million that we're trying to raise, 15.8 of that is going to be hopefully through tax revenue, both the sales tax and the property referendum. Not, I think I said 7, but I was only looking at the sales tax part of that. So it's 15.8 from the community, and then $5.4 million we're going to hopefully raise privately through a private capital campaign and other other funding sources that don't involve raising taxes. So what I got wrong was I think I said 7 million, but it's really not 7. It's 7 plus 8.8, so for a total of 15.8 for that double sheet arena. So anyway, that's the correction. I just read the wrong number
so
from my notes.
To make it simple and comprehensive, the word is it's going to cost $21 million, and some people may think that's going to be through the referendum if there is one, and that wouldn't be true because there's going to be private input. So consequently, for the taxpayers, it would be $15 million approximately instead of $21 million.
Right, and yeah, it's a collaboration between private interests. You know, the Hockey Association plan is going to be donating the land that was donated to them, and then, you know, so that's a private contribution that's already on the table, and then we're going to try to raise another $5.4 million onto that, which basically it works out to be the difference between the cost of a single sheet of ice and a second sheet of ice. If we can raise the $5.4 million and add that into the tax revenue that hopefully will be raised, then we get to that $21 million number.
One of the questions I did ask you, and I want to ask it again, in that I know that the DeHousie family, originally from Plainview, then Northfield, and then Lakeville, donated a great deal of money to the hockey rink up in Lakeville, Minnesota, right. And they call it the DeHousie Arena. And I asked you if you had a sugar daddy, and I shouldn't have put it that way. Do you know of anybody that has the wealth and the concern and desire to maybe have a project that would be named after their family and help considerably?
Well, not yet. Okay. You know, the hope is once we get ourselves a little bit more organized and start this capital campaign in a more formal way, we'll be reaching out to as many people and as many companies as we can to see if we can't try to find that type of a donor. You know, capital campaigns, like I think we talked about earlier or last week, I mean, I was pretty well involved with the initial years of starting the private capital campaign that ultimately resulted in the funds that were raised for the YMCA in Northfield. And capital campaigns, you know, they take a while, but once you know exactly what you're raising money for, then it makes it a lot easier to reach out to the potential donors and the potential families and the potential companies that could support that. You know, there's also the notion of selling the naming rights for the new arena. You know, the current arena, sometimes people refer to it as the Pepsi Arena. I think it's because there's a Pepsi sign on the outside of
really?
It. But I don't know that there's ever been an actual formal agreement that allows for it to be called that. I mean, I'm not aware of Pepsi actually funding anything associated with our arena other than that little sign that's on the outside of it right now. So, you know, there's a lot of creative ways that we're trying to approach the task of trying to raise that $5.4 million to get to the point where we can build the community arena in combination with the tax revenue that we're hoping will be approved both by the voters of Northfield and also Dundas.
Well, I have to tell you that I've been chairman of the board of the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting in St. Louis Park, and I still am on the committee. And when we approach major donors, mm-hmm. it's always about education. And if you can show people like Best Buy and other corporate sponsors that what's happening is going to be beneficial to the youth of the community, that is was always the key part in our particular efforts. And then while fundraising to support Defeated Jesse James Day celebration. That, again, is an education when you think about it, because you want people from out of town to come to our town and get educated on what a great community we are. So I would imagine you have your eye on some people that are altruistic, that would want to support the education of competitiveness and teamwork.
Yeah, you know, it's a similar theme, really, to when I first got involved with the YMCA. You know, I grew up in Gillette, Wyoming, which is a town in northeast Wyoming that always had a very strong parks and recreation department funded through the city. So they had fantastic facilities. They had a rec center. And, you know, growing up in Gillette, when we, you know, as kids didn't have much to do, we would go to the rec center and we'd play pickup basketball games and volleyball games. I mean, having the recreational facilities available in a city, I think, is really important for a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, you want to try to keep the kids as busy as possible, to keep them moving, keep them, you know, on a competitive team. I think that teaches a lot of really good things to kids. I mean, you learn how to respond to a coach. You learn how to play as a team. You learn how to show up for practice on time, you know, commit yourself to whatever it is that you're doing. And one of the reasons why I originally got involved with the YMCA is because I, you know, pretty quickly realized that Northfield doesn't really have a parks and recreation department like I was used to growing up. So you see a lot of kids who, you know, there's a lot of kids who perhaps are with families that can't afford the private funds that are necessary for these private sporting associations to proceed forward. And if you don't make the varsity team or the JV team in high school, then there's a large amount of kids in our community that don't have the benefit of that organized, structured activity, you know, associated with athletics. I mean, there's a private soccer association, there's a tennis association, lacrosse association, hockey association. I mean, Northfield is doing a pretty good job, you know, with all of the volunteer effort associated with those.
That's a lot of candy bars.
It is. Yeah, you know, and I think it's, I don't know the history of it. I know that it is, in fact, different from what I was used to back in Gillette. Now, in Gillette, of course, we had a lot of tax revenue coming from the coal and oil resources that are in the Powder River Basin. So, you know, I think you're dealing with a pretty dramatically different tax base. But the opportunity for kids to be able to recreate and hang out and be involved is so critically important to the health of a city. So, you know, I think the community ice arena, I think, will help in that. It'll provide a facility for, certainly for hockey players and figure skaters, and hopefully we can expand that out as much as possible to tennis players and lacrosse players and connect it to the bike route and all that other stuff.
By the way, it's an obvious question. if you were seeking dollars, is there any connection to the Gillette Razor company?
No. You're going to test my memory here on the history. The city of Gillette was named after an early homesteader who came through that area. Has nothing to do with the Gillette company that makes the
Well, what a natural ask.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, they, you know, when I was growing up, they called it the Razor City. Because of that, but now it's I think called the Energy City, because it's more focused on coal and oil. And
I don't know if it went over your head or not, but when you mentioned Gillette last time, Wisconsin, I said, "Hey, I've been there, Wyoming,
right?"
And I played golf there,
yeah.
And when you hit the ball, it would go on forever and ever after it landed on the ground. Did that go over your head, or did you get what I meant?
No, I totally know what you mean. Yeah, it's a high elevation, arid environment. So it's, you know, takes a lot of water to keep that golf course green.
Yeah, but
and a lot of the fairways are not green through
right.
the summer.
Right. Yeah.
Know, in the
it's like hitting it on a parking lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it goes forever. Well, here comes a part at 17 minutes after 9 o'clock on KYMN Radio, where I am going to have the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Sorensen, and find out about something I've always wanted to know about, and that is patent. I don't know about you, maybe I asked you this question before, but it's okay to be redundant. I mean, they have reruns on television all the time. And that is the show Shark Tank.
Yeah, I know of it. I haven't really watched it all that
and
much.
One of the questions they ask when entrepreneurs come in asking for financial support for a piece of their company is when they present a product, they'll say, is it patented? And they'll say, well, we have patent pending. Okay, now, I would like to know what is the difference between a patent and a patent pending other than the obvious. Are you secure when you have patent pending?
Well, no, you're not. What it means is that there is an application that is pending before the United States Patent and Trademark Office, which means that it's being examined by the Patent Office to determine whether the device is actually new or novel or useful. And so the Patent Office, it's in Alexandria, Virginia. They employ, you know, a literal army of scientists and experts in patent law who do extensive searching to try to determine whether your device is actually something nobody has ever done before. And if it is, if it passes that threshold review, then there's a process of communications back and forth between the inventor and the patent office to try to define as precisely as they can in the patent what their invention is. And once they define that, then the patent issues. And once the patent issues, then you have this, it's essentially a government-granted monopoly that gives you the right in federal court to exclude others from practicing your invention.
And is that a 7-year limit? Or, like, for example, in drugs, somebody comes out with a drug that's new and does different things and blah, 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 and then nobody can make a generic form of that drug for 7 years. Am I right on something like that?
What you're talking about is called regulatory exclusivity. And that is an exclusivity that's granted by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Once it's called a new chemical entity, so if a new drug is developed and is approved by the FDA as both being safe and effective for what the drug is supposed to treat, the FDA will grant that 7-year period where no other applicant can file a generic application for that period. That's called new chemical entity exclusivity. So that's an exclusivity that is imposed by the FDA. And of course, you can't sell a prescription drug in the United States without it first being approved by the FDA. So no, that's not patent law. That's more FDA or pharmaceutical regulatory exclusivity.
Let's say I invented a gadget.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the patent pending, and then I get the patent on it. Does that run out in 7 years?
No, patents, it gets a little complicated, but generally speaking, if you have a patent, you have a period of 17 years of exclusivity for the life of that patent. And that patent can be 20 years depending upon how long it took for the patent office to examine it. So it's either 17 years or 20 years life of a patent. So a patent's significantly longer period of time.
So somebody could start making that gadget 20 years later to be competitive with the originator.
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, really, that's the whole purpose of the patent system, frankly. There is a sort of a grand bargain for exchange. So in exchange for an inventor disclosing his or her invention to the world in the patent itself, the government will grant that inventor this period of time where they have the right to keep others from practicing it. But the whole notion of disclosing it to the world is so that your competitors can understand what your patent rights are and design around those patent rights. And in that designing around process, innovation occurs. So it's sort of a it's a system where as long as you understand clearly what another person's patent rights are, you can work hard to try to figure out how to develop a better product or an improvement on that product, an improvement that gets around those claims. It incentivizes further innovation.
Our guest this morning is Chris Sorensen, and he is a patent lawyer. And I got a couple of more questions before I dig into your life and how you ended up in Northfield from Gillette, Wisconsin. Excuse me, why do I keep saying Wisconsin? Wyoming, okay. And that would be, if I know my history, the Patent Office for the United States of America, which started, I think, in the 1800s, would require a full-size model of whatever you have invented. So let's take, for example, a steam engine or some big piece of equipment, and they literally had to show them full-size and how it works. And then they changed that you could come in with a small size sample that is exactly like the big one's going to work. Or can you help me out on that one?
Yeah, I don't think that if they did require the full-sized embodiment of the invention, it wasn't for very long because it came pretty quickly to the realization that they would never have enough space. So I think pretty quickly it came into those scale models, the actual scale models. One clarification, though, Wayne, I'm not a patent attorney. I do the litigation and the trial work to either enforce or defend against patents being asserted by companies. To be a patent attorney, you have to pass a special bar, and you have to have the scientific background to qualify for that. So it's important just because I'm an attorney. I'm not a patent attorney. I have for the last 20 years done nothing other than litigating patents in federal court. But that means that I'm a trial attorney first. I'm not a patent attorney. I'm a trial attorney that knows patent law really well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't want to misrepresent you at all. I had kind of an interesting thing happen with KYMN Radio in 1983. On March 3rd, 1983, at 6 a.m., KYMN Radio AM went stereo. And the only other place there was an AM stereo station was in New York City and Los Angeles. Hmm. And we were the first in the entire Midwest. And I'm very proud of that. But after about 2 weeks being on the air in stereo, we got a message from the FCC to cease and desist immediately. And that meant we had to shut off our AM stereo right in the middle of a huge promotion. Hmm. Well, it turned out that a fellow by the name of Kahn had invented AM stereo on how to broadcast that. Well, then others like from Motorola and others came in on top of that. Well, the reason we had a cease and desist was because of a schematic that was presented to the engineering office of the FCC wasn't exactly the way it was being functionally used, and was settled quickly because it made really no difference other than a line from point A to point B might have went to point C and then back to point A. And had no, it's more than I can comprehend.
Right.
But, I mean, in my lifetime, I've been in some battles, and that was one of them right there. And that guy thought he had a patent on it, and ultimately, because of all the bickering, and nobody could really settle in on one of the car dealers did, it eventually went away. And that's too bad, because it was terrific.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. You know, that's the tension with, trying to incentivize innovation. So try to give a reward for people who come up with something that's actually new and novel and useful and worthy of a patent, with also trying to protect competitors who are not, who they believe are not infringing on the property right that's granted in the patent. And those disputes happen quite often, and, you know, depending upon the technology at the time, are extraordinarily important. You know, the intellectual property rights of a lot of the companies today are really their primary asset when it comes to being able to protect their market share and protect their business, you know, by preventing others from copying whatever it is that makes the invention valuable. You know, and so, yeah, it sounds to me like that must have been a dispute over the technology initially developed to be able to broadcast over FM frequencies in stereo. In stereo AM yeah. frequencies yeah. in stereo. So
We had an interesting thing happen. Now, I know that you are not a trademark guy, but you know more about trademarks than I do.
Sure.
And about three or four, boy, the time flies, maybe 4 years ago, the Defeated Jesse James Day Committee sponsored what we called a soapbox derby. Mm-hmm. Now, you've heard of soapbox derbies, right?
Yeah.
It originally started in Ohio, and I believe it was sponsored by, like, Goodyear or some tire manufacturer. And it was a competition of building a non-motorized four-wheel vehicle to go straight down a hill. And ours went straight down, then they had to take a right, straight down, then they had to take a left, straight down to the finish line, mm-hmm. which requires more engineering, if you will, to have the soapbox derby car turn right and left with brakes and the whole bit. And it's a wonderful, wonderful competition. It's on Saturday morning during Defeated Jesse James Days. Starts off right in front of Thank You, St. John's Church. Mm-hmm. And if you ever get a chance, go watch that. But I got a letter from the soapbox derby people that said, cease and desist using the terminology soapbox derby.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, who are the soapbox people now? I mean,
they're the ones that originated the competition that was a real big deal back in the 50s.
Yeah.
And it was Life magazine covered it and the whole bit. And that was their name, Soapbox Derby.
Yeah, you know, if they have that trade name and they were actually in, you know, commerce trading off of that name and they had a registered trademark, I suppose that makes sense. You
and
know,
our lawyer, Dave Vistendahl, said cease and desist.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say is, you know, a lot of folks will send out a cease and desist letter like that, and they may or may not actually have the right to preclude you from using that name. The best thing to do is get in touch with an attorney who understands trademark law before you do anything, because you may not have to cease and desist. And it all sort of depends.
When you consider the cost of an attorney to check that out, would wipe away any profit and have a tremendous cost, I would assume.
Well, it depends on what it is that you're trying to continue to do. Here, I assume that it's not something that was actually making much money. It was more of an event during Defeated Jesse James Day. So, yeah, that makes sense. And it also depends on the attorney. I mean, I tell friends and family to always make sure that you're finding an attorney who really understands trademark law, because it's a deceptively complicated area of law, and it really... You know, somebody who understands the area can spend 10 minutes giving you an answer. Someone who doesn't really understand that area might have to spend 2 or 3 hours researching to figure out what the answer is. So, you know, the attorney can be a lot less expensive when you, you know, find somebody that really knows that area of law really well.
Well, we did apply, we being the Defeated Jesse James Day Committee, to trademark Defeated Jesse James Days and maybe... Jesse James Days, and not sure. But then we most recently had trademark DJJD.
Right.
The committee owns that. So nobody can make T-shirts or anything like that other than our company and our committee.
Right.
And the permission from the committee. So it's kind of interesting, a nonprofit organization that puts on a wonderful celebration sometimes gets involved mm-hmm. with legal aspects of various things, and it's a lot of paperwork. I assume you probably do a whole lot of paperwork, and I'll have your answer right after we have a message, all right?
Sure.
My guest this morning on KYMN Radio is Chris Sorensen, and he is an attorney that lives here in town but works in the cities, correct?
Yeah, I work in downtown Minneapolis. Yeah.
Downtown Minneapolis. That's fun to go to work every day. I'll be right back.
Spring is officially here. Mother's Day and prom are both this weekend, and Judy's Floral Design on Division Street across from the middle school is ready. Judy's Floral Design has an array of marvelous flowers to pick from. Or browse judysfreshfloraldesign.com for a large selection of arrangements and price ranges. Happy Mother's Day. And remember, no matter if it's prom or mom, Judy's Florals is ready for flowers to become a part of your day. Girls Night Out is back. Ladies, call your friends and head to downtown Northfield on Friday, May 11th for the 11th annual Girls Night Out, presented by the Northfield Area Chamber of Commerce. This will be a great night of dining, deals, and drawings at downtown shops and restaurants. The festivities kick off at 4 o'clock and go well into the evening. Stop into Girls Night Out sponsors to register for your chance to win $475 in chamber bucks.
Girls Night Out is proud to be sponsored by Fine Fettle, Honest Closet, Beerman's Home Furnishing and Floor Coverings, and a Bag Lady, along with many other fine sponsors.
Hey, it's your stomach again. Subway has all new signature wraps, and around the water cooler, the other stomachs can't stop talking about them. Chipotle Southwest Steak and Cheese, Turkey Bacon and Guac, Rotisserie Style Chicken Caesar Signature Wraps. Listen, if I'm honest, as a talking stomach, I don't have a lot of life experience, but I do know one thing. These signature wraps are jam-packed with meat. So what are you waiting for? I'm growling over here. Subway, make it what you want.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair on this absolutely gorgeous, beautiful Thursday morning. This is May 10th, and the year is 2018, and my guest is a gentleman by the name of... do you recognize his song? Christopher.
Yeah, the mic. I do. I recognize it from back in my... Gillette days, but the name of the song isn't coming to my mind at the moment.
It's called Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now, done by Jefferson Starship.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, we were taking that break. I just ran in there and just grabbed one. I said, I'm going to get something from the late 80s. when did you graduate from high school?
1988.
Oh, perfect, yeah. Almost. They listened to popular music in Wyoming?
Well, of course. You know, that was the early days of MTV.
You know, it's something I've never watched.
Well, you know, I don't watch it anymore, but back in the 80s, it was kind of a big deal, right? You know, they were doing something that was new and interesting. So yeah, trying to remember the name of our radio station in Gillette. I don't think it's there anymore. There was an FM station that had some DJs that did a pretty good job of, you know, bringing in a lot of the newest music.
Going to radio school, and when you graduated, they guaranteed placement or assistant placement. And Broken Elbow, Wyoming was kind of an inside joke. Like, hey, you know, you might get a job out in Broken Elbow, Wyoming. So that's what, but I love Wyoming. I love, my wife and I motorcycled through there, and it's beautiful. When they say home on the range, yeah. I mean, wow, you go, holy cow, nothing, just this road.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that. So our guest this morning is a gentleman, an attorney, and it's a kind of an inside joke that I kind of tease attorneys.
Sure.
And I told you a joke the other day. Did you remember it?
I remembered it was funny. I'm trying to remember what it...
You laughed out loud.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear a lot of lawyer jokes.
The lawyer and the guy that rides a Harley.
Oh, that's right.
One passes the bar, the other one never passes the bar.
That's right.
All right. So we're going to establish now the fact that you are a guy that goes to court for people over a patent or patent pending. You must be heavily loaded with paperwork.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, a lot of our job is submitting a lot of briefs and a lot of a lot of paperwork. You know, the fun part of my job is working with inventors or working with scientists who have figured out a way around an invention. So you learn, you know, I'm constantly learning about different aspects of different inventions, and that's fantastic. It makes the paperwork all worth it. And, of course, being in trial. You know, I originally went to law school because I wanted to do trial work, and patent trials are very, very fun. You know, they're only in federal court, and they're pretty significant productions.
Is it a judge or a jury?
It depends. In the pharmaceutical space, where I do a lot of my work, it's only to a judge. In the non-pharmaceutical space, if there are damages at issue, so if somebody is actually selling a product that's alleged to infringe and there's an amount of damages that are associated with that infringing activity, then by law it has to be in front of a jury. So, you know, most patent cases go before juries.
12-person?
Correct, 12-person jury.
Okay.
In federal court.
Well, you're so laid back. I can't see you in the well. I like to call it the well. Have you ever referred to it as the well?
I've heard that before.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's a good description.
Yeah, it is.
So you don't seem like you'd be the fire and brimstone like, hey, these are infringing on my invention and blah, 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 and I did this. And that's why I thought it's probably a lot of paperwork.
You know, the trial work itself is, there are briefs that are filed, but the trial work itself is more a matter of storytelling, especially patent cases. You know, they're not like Perry Mason dramatic trials. I mean, things that happen that have a lot of drama in my mind at a patent trial, you know, they're not all that exciting. It's a matter of getting an expert to admit that they've drawn a conclusion that's not reliable or trying to, you know, establish your point, but you're really telling a story to the jury about what was invented and how it's improved life in whatever area it might be. Or if you're on the other side, that they really didn't invent that. Somebody else had invented that before. And, you know, you try to piece together a convincing story and explain the technology involved in a way that either a district court judge or a jury can understand so that they can make the right decision. So, you know, you'd have to experience a patent trial to understand what I'm saying. It's not, you know, only the nerds in patent law think they're really exciting, I think, but the real challenge is to try to get a jury to understand the technology and understand the underlying justice associated with finding one way or another on a particular technology.
Well, you know, sometimes people don't realize the power and one person has, as in a judge, and you know, I think most Americans think of any litigation as a jury, and the judge just keeps it moving along.
Right.
But boy, oh boy, that one person can make decisions that can involve millions, if not billions, of dollars, and to convince that one individual that there's an infringement or vice versa. It has to be frustrating because you got to convince one guy, but then again, sometimes it's even better, I suppose, because this person's more knowledgeable and open and can comprehend what you're talking about. So, another question. Was I right on that, by the way?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, of course, every judge is subject to appellate review. So, you know, that's true. The judges do have a lot of authority and a lot of power, and that's really probably how it should be, you know, because if you have two commercial interests that are in battling over a particular market, you know, there could be billions of dollars at stake either way. And the evidentiary rulings that the judge makes will influence the trial dramatically. But, you know, I've been doing this for a long time now, and I think that you especially in federal court, you develop a very healthy respect for the high level of integrity that exists on the federal bench. And they're extraordinarily hardworking. They're very, very, very smart public servants. And they're really trying to just make the right decision, whatever that decision may be. And especially in patent cases, you know, they have a choice between two competing points of view, who either one of them could be right, depending upon how you're looking at the situation. And so, yeah, they do have a lot of power. But, you know, I've grown to develop a great amount of respect for the heavy responsibility associated with being a federal judge. And I've had nothing but very good experiences with them. You know, they don't always find in my client's favor, but they're always trying to make what they believe to be the right decision.
In your 20 years experience, what was the longest ongoing case that you may still be involved in?
So over the last 10 years, I've been doing almost exclusively these pharmaceutical cases, and they're a little different because they're by statute. They have to be completed within 30 months. So they're pretty condensed and short. You know, I think the longest ongoing commercial dispute probably lasted about 6 years. It was in Nebraska. The case was venued in Nebraska, and it just took a very long time to get everything together, to get both of the parties completed with all the pretrial discovery that goes on and all the depositions. So about 6 years, which was unusually long. In federal court, they're pretty prompt. You know, they don't mess around. They'll set a scheduling order and they'll set a trial date, and you have to live by that.
And can you reveal what? Well, I imagine you can, because it's public information. What was a 6-year deal over?
That was a you know, my client had technology. They're insulated concrete forms, so they're a form that is a relatively new building technology where you have styrofoam panels that are situated in parallel with a space between them, and they're connected by a plastic bridge, and you put concrete in between the two styrofoam panels and then stack them up and build walls then that are 6 inches or 12 inches thick of concrete with polystyrene panels on either side, and then you can put the sheetrock on the inside and the exterior on the outside. It's a building technology, insulated concrete forms. So I represented a company that held a patent family on their particular design of their insulated concrete form, and the lawsuit was associated with a company in Nebraska that had developed a product that we believed was infringing on the patents that my client held.
Well, it seems like a pretty common, obvious solution for insulation. And I suppose it was the way they did it. Not that they used styrofoam on each side, but the way they connected it.
Yeah, you know, it was really associated with the design of the way in which the forms join together as you stack them on top of each other.
Okay.
And it was a design of how they fit together in a way that allowed for a strong seam. You know, like if you have an 8-foot wall and you're pouring concrete 8 feet high, the force at the bottom of that stack is going to be pretty severe. The concrete's going to kind of want to try to, you know, come out of that interior space. And so it was a matter of the design of it was called the interlock system. Okay. So they developed a way in which the forms would fit together and form a really strong seam, but would also be really flexible on the job site so that you could cut half blocks and put them here, and they were reversible. So you could put each block, it didn't matter whether it was right side up or upside down or left to right or right to left, they would all fit together as you were building the structure. Ways in which that make the form stronger and also make it easier for the contractors to be able to build it efficiently and with the minimum amount of error. That's really where the patent rights were. It wasn't necessarily a claim to have invented the insulated concrete form itself. It was efficient way in which to put them together.
And somebody else did that cut and was using it, and these people had it patented.
That's right.
And who did you represent?
I represented it's a company, a Canadian company called Polyform, and their exclusive distributor in the United States, a company called Nudura.
Nudura?
Nudura, yep. So there are Nudura distributors throughout the United States. There's a couple in Minnesota as well. It's actually it's a really neat technology. It's a little bit more expensive than typical, 2x4 wood construction. So you spend a little bit more in the initial, but it's dramatically more efficient to both heat and cool buildings that are constructed with this technology. And it's really taking off. Now, the case that I was involved in was about 10 years ago, and back then it was, just kind of getting started. Now there's a lot of companies and there's a lot of development and there's a lot of ICF construction going on today.
What is ICF?
That's short for insulated concrete form.
Oh, okay.
So ICF. Yeah.
All right. It's 12 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair. My guest this morning is a fellow by the name of Mr. Gillette, Wyoming. No, wait a minute. Chris, I'm sorry. Sorensen is his name. We'll be back in just a moment.
It takes special skills to be a Daikin Comfort Pro. Let's listen in as he senses an old inefficient system's imminent demise.
So costly. Tormented by an ongoing battle over the thermostat. Its days are numbered.
You got all that by waving your hand in the air in our living room?
Get to know your local Daikin Comfort Pro.
This is Andy Straits with Straits 72 Degrees, your local third generation business. Call me at 645-4040 or straitsheating.com.
You were a junior in high school when this was popular.
Was I a junior? That seems like it's more like the middle school years. This is Los Lobos, right?
Yeah, 1987.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Well, that's something we have in common. That song was very popular when I was a junior in high school. And
It was Ritchie Valens, right?
Yeah, Ritchie Valens. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think it was on the other side of the song O Donna on a 45 record. Oh, I try to sing along with that, but I just can't do it. Of course, that was the number 5 song in all of 1987, and it was performed, like my guest said, Los Lobos. And Chris, or Christopher.
Chris is fine.
Okay. Chris Sorensen, my guest on KYMN Radio, and we're asking various questions about his profession, which is it's something I couldn't do because I couldn't sit at a desk and look things up constantly. What about this? Is there an ethics law or federal law that says you as an attorney representing a company, stay at arm's length in regards to investing?
Yeah, there certainly is. It's not a law per se, but it is it's the Minnesota Code of Professional Responsibility, which is modeled off a federal code. And yes, you have to be very careful about having an invested interest in your client's business. It's not prohibited automatically. It's just that you need to be really careful about having a conflict of interest, so to speak, with regard to your role as an officer of the court and whether or not you personally might benefit or not from the outcome of the case.
It's not illegal, but it's unethical some cases.
In some instances, it can be unethical. It's very hard to paint with a broad brush, any particular conduct is unethical or not, but there are rules that govern the conflict of interest situation that could arise from having an ownership interest in your client's business.
I am flabbergasted at how much it costs to present a patent and write it out till it's approved. It's really expensive, isn't it?
Well, like any lawyer, I'm going to say it depends. It can be very expensive, yes. If you're trying to prosecute a patent claim for an improvement of a well-developed area, it can take a long time to convince the patent office exactly what improvement you're entitled to a patent for. But it can also be true that if you have something that's really completely brand new, the preparation of the patent application and the prosecution of that application in front of the patent office can be very quick and can be very short. So, you know, again, yes, it can be very expensive, but the important thing is you really need to find a trusted counselor that can help you understand just how much the application is going to cost, but also help you understand, in the event that you are able to get a patent, what that application and what that patent would be worth in the marketplace after you achieve it. So it's a complicated analysis. And, you know, if you have, you know, let's say that you've come up with a new gadget that everybody is going to love, and you're going to make your, you know, you have all your marketing and your manufacturing, you have everything lined up, and it's something that you think is going to make a lot of money, then the cost of filing for and prosecuting and achieving patent protection for that idea becomes, relatively speaking, quite small in contrast to the amount of market influence that patent could allow you to have, right? So, you know, my firm does a lot of prosecution for a lot of very large companies. Microsoft is one of them. And, for instance, you know, that there's a giant structure in place that allows for very large companies to be able to protect their market space via their patent portfolio and their patent families. And so, yes, it can be expensive, but the reward of having the ability to keep others from practicing what your invention is makes the cost of the patent much more patentable, like, okay, you know, much more palatable.
I get that. I have to take another break.
Sure.
And then when I come back, I have another question.
Okay.
We are in the studios of KYMN Radio in downtown Northfield, Minnesota.
Do you have a wedding in your future? Is navigating the options for your big day leaving your head spinning? Not to worry. We have good news for you. On Thursday, May 10th, head to the second annual Northfield Area Wedding Vendor Fair at the Gardens of Castle Rock. With over 35 vendors, every aspect of your special day will be covered. From venues to caterers, wedding planners to florists, photographers to DJs, and everything in between. Go to the Gardens of Castle Rock Facebook page to check out the video from last year's fair. Click on the link at kymnradio.net for more information and to register for the fair and your chance to win cash prizes at the Northfield Area Wedding Vendor Fair, Thursday, May 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Gardens of Castle Rock.
Three Links Auxiliary and Greenvale Park Elementary PTO will be co-hosting a fundraising rummage sale on Friday, May 18th, 8 to 5, and Saturday, the 19th, 8 to 2. It's located at our lodge on the corner of Oddfellows Lane and Highway 19 across from Post Brands. In the main room, everything is just a dollar. The treasure room will have special prices. We'll be serving walking tacos and treats. You'll find clothing, houseware, decor, books, puzzles, bed, bath, collectibles, a variety of perennials, and much more.
We're back on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio with our guest on Kim, Christopher Sorensen, and we are talking about patents, ladies and gentlemen. This is music from 1987. Name this tune.
This is Bon Jovi. I don't remember the name, though, the song.
Well, it's kind of like your clients that are seeking a patent, and they're praying that it goes through. And they're living the anticipatory life. Those were hints, yeah, by the way.
I know, I'm trying to... I mean, I know the song. I know it's Bon Jovi.
Living
on a dream or something like
living
that?
Living on a prayer.
On a prayer, okay.
Not that I know this stuff. I just read it here. At 3 minutes before 10 o'clock, here's my question. Did you know the late Peter Schmitz?
No.
He had his attorney office right north of us here in the Nutting Building.
Well, no, I did not.
Well, when he was president of the Minnesota Bar Association, they voted on whether they should advertise.
Oh, yeah.
On electronic media,
mm-hmm,
and it passed. And we have been inundated by lawyers ever since. Ambulance chasers, whatever you want to call it. So the reason I ask about the cost of getting a patent is because now you have people advertising on television about a patent application, CS. I don't know if that's your company or not. But,
no, it's not.
Anyhow, I almost get a feeling of a shyster, you know. Hey, you invented something. I'll check it out. And if I believe in it, I want 30% of the company and we'll go for it. Plus, give me another $25,000. That's the way I interpret it.
Yeah. You know, I think I know about the commercials that you're speaking of. My law firm is Merchant & Gould, and we've been an intellectual property law firm for more than 110 years now. You know, we specialize in intellectual property, and we have, you know, attorneys who have been doing it for a very, very, very long time. And so I guess, yeah, not all of those, we don't advertise like that. I mean, you know, we develop our relationships with our clients by virtue of doing very good work for them over the years. And then they have, you know, word of mouth. So those commercials where those companies have to be careful. They, you know, you can file a patent application for virtually anything, and filing the application does not by any stretch of the imagination mean that you're actually going to get a patent out of it. And, you know, my advice would be, if you do think that you have a new idea or you have something that's worth
the
some
old
patent
better
protection, is you need
mouse
to
trap.
Yeah, you need to find an attorney who really understands the law and who can think about what it is that you're trying to do in the context of what's in your best interests, not what might be in the best interests of the attorney, which may be to file an application or which may be to, you know, generate some revenue off of what that person may or may not know is actually not a very good idea.
A minute before 10, we're going to take a little break.
Sure.
Maybe we'll wait till after the break so you can get the full answer on that. But I'm going to ask you after the break if I remember.
Okay.
How many or how often do you ever have somebody come in with intellectual property and need to, an explanation of what that is? I kind of got an idea where you say, you know what, this is really, really going to be a big deal. I want to, you know, buy some stock in this company or have a privilege to be a purchaser of stock if the patent, blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean.
Sure.
Okay. We'll take this break on KYMN Radio. My guest this morning is Christopher Sorensen, a very pleasant fella. We are in the studios in downtown Northfield. KYMN 1080 AM radio for nearly 50 years, and of course now the one, 95.1 FM.
Home free Mideast rocket barrage. I'm John Trout. Vice President Pence tells ABC News nothing was offered in exchange for the release of three now former detainees held by North Korea.
Nothing in exchange, and yet we do see like this remarkable moment of three Americans coming home.
The trio welcomed this morning by President Trump at Joint Base Andrews. Military confrontation overnight between Israel and Iran from positions in Syria. Correspondent Oren Lieberman describes the exchange.
Shortly after midnight here that the IDF, the Israeli military, says some 20 rockets were fired from Iranian forces behind me here in Syria across from the occupied Golan Heights towards Israeli military positions not far from where we're standing. Israel responded very quickly with a combination of surface-to-surface missiles, airstrikes, and more.
Germany, France, and Russia are calling for de-escalation of tensions. Britain is condemning the attack on Israel. The White House has expressed support for Israel's right to act in self-defense. defense. In Hawaii, new concerns on measurements from inside Mount Kilauea.
Officials say if the lava lake drops below the water table, which it is near now, a powerful steam explosion could result, sending boulders weighing 10 to 12 tons into the air and an ash cloud that could block the sun for weeks.
There's Jim Roop. The volcano continues to spatter and ooze lava into a residential area. Correspondent Evan Perez is reporting that Donald Trump attorney Michael Cohen sought to take advantage of his status after the inauguration of President Trump.
Multiple people familiar with Cohen's behavior say he aggressively pitched himself to potential clients as having access to the most powerful man in the world. One source describing Cohen's sales pitch as, quote, "I don't know who's been representing you, but you should fire them all. I'm the guy you should hire. I'm closest to the president. I'm his personal lawyer."
Cohen is currently under investigation for a payment to porn actress Stormy Daniels. I'm John Trout.
Get it? I get it. I still can't remember the name of the song. I know it's the Beatles. But
When I'm 64.
When I'm 64. Got it.
You know, when they recorded that song back in about 1967, they thought 64 was old. And most of the Beatles, surviving ones, are the same age as me. You know, one or two years younger or older. So probably younger. But anyhow, that's why I use that for a theme song, right. 64. At 3 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, what a gorgeous, glorious morning. It is 10:03 and the sun is shining brightly. And I have a very bright person in studio right now, attorney Christopher Sorensen. He lives in Northfield and commutes to downtown Minneapolis. And we haven't even gotten started on his life. I know it's going to begin in a place called Gillette, Wyoming. I bought a sport jacket from a Western wear store in downtown Gillette.
Hmm.
And we stayed in an, it seems to me, at the edge of town. And then we went into town and we had something to eat in a place that had a outdoor patio by the street, Main Street. This is several years ago.
Yeah, it's the old post office building that's been converted into a restaurant.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, it is really nice. I can't remember the name of the restaurant, though.
But you know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking about, yeah.
And sometimes I don't know what I'm talking about, but I know you do when I ask a question. What was the question I was going to ask you?
I think it had something to do with having folks who come with a great idea and whether the attorneys can have an ownership interest in that idea.
Yeah, that was the idea. Because, right. First of all, we talked about the people that are yelling and screaming on the TV screen saying, hey, if you've invented something, come to us.
Right.
And I just get that feeling like, boy, I'm going to take and charge you a lot, and I'm going to get a piece of your company, blah, 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 blah. So tell me a story about somebody you represented that you said, oh, my God, this is going to go through, and it's one of the best ideas ever. How can I get in on the action?
Well, you know, one of my favorite stories to tell, and you know, remember, I'm not the attorney that actually gets your patent from the patent office. I'm the attorney that will enforce your patent if you need to once you have it. So most of the discussions that I have with people who think they have ideas is really a matter of me thinking, okay, that sounds pretty neat, but I need to get you to the right lawyer to tell you whether that's something that you should actually invest in to get an application, right? So I'm not the patent lawyer. I'm more the trial lawyer that enforces the patents.
Okay.
But, you know, one of my favorite clients over the years is he started... I'm not sure if I just said, yeah, it's in the public record, and he'll forgive me. His name is Chuck Mann.
Chuck Mann?
Mann, yeah, and he was a lift operator at a ski resort in Colorado in the 80s. And he had an idea for a dog treat, for a dog toy. And basically, he had a golden lab who was destroying tennis balls right and left, and he had the idea of, he got a racquetball once and carved into the racquetball a space to put in a dog biscuit. And, of course, the lab loved it, and that kind of gave him the idea of, well, wait a second, what if I made a more solid, substantial rubber ball and we put up space where we can stick in a dog biscuit, and then you put ridges on the rubber ball so when the dog's chewing on the biscuit, the dog is also cleaning its teeth. And that became the biscuit bouncer. And he had the foresight to file a patent application on his biscuit bouncer and started off with prototypes that he sold out of the trunk of his car to primarily veterinarians within Minnesota, because he had moved to Minnesota when he was getting this business started. So he went to vets and said, look, this is a dog toy that actually, when the dogs start chewing on it, it'll clean their teeth. It'll help to clean their teeth. And vets loved it. And he sold his first trunk full of biscuit bouncers right away, and he reinvested his money and got some more and sold those right away and reinvested his money and got some more and sold those right away. And before long, he was getting contracts for the sale of his product in, you know, larger retail stores like Target. And that drew the attention of the Kong company.
Which company?
Kong, K-O-N-G. They have a lot of these rubber dog toys out there. And
made in China type?
I think mostly, yeah, they're okay. Made in China. Anyway, Kong asserted a patent that they had on some of their toys against Chuck and his brand new company, alleging that the biscuit bouncer was an infringement of one of Kong's toys, and Chuck hired me, and I was at a different law firm at the time, and we essentially went to battle against Kong, a giant manufacturer in the dog toy industry.
David and Goliath.
Yeah, quite literally. And we eventually were able to prevail in that lawsuit. We were able to get a settlement, and it allowed Chuck to then continue to build his business and win more contracts with more large manufacturers. And his company ended up, it was Man Design initially, and then it was Premier Pets for a while. So he sold his initial business to Premier Pets. Premier Pets then was sold to another company, another larger company. And, you know, it's kind of one of those success stories about somebody who having a very, very good idea, having the foresight to protect that idea very early on, even when he didn't have a lot of money to invest very early on, and being able to then survive in the marketplace with a better product and get the shelf space that he needed to, you know, have the revenue come in to be able to then develop more products. And so, you know, if you go to vet stores, you'll see the Premier pet toys everywhere. They're the purple ones.
Yeah, Vikings.
Yeah, and it's just a great story. He's just a creative, entrepreneurial, regular guy who had a wonderful idea and had the foresight to do what he needed to do to protect it.
Were you then arguing before a judge or a jury?
That case actually never actually went to trial because we were able to establish some pretty strong defenses. And so the case settled. But it would have gone to a jury.
And Kong was thinking that, or contending that, he was infringing on their ideas.
Yeah, Kong had this toy and some broad patents around this particular type of toy that they believed Chuck's toy infringed upon. And we didn't think that that was the case.
So how does that work then? Does Chuck get a settlement from Kong? Or does they go away?
Well, the terms of the settlement are confidential, but, you know, basically both sides got together and realized that it was in their best interest to settle and stop
the litigation.
Stop the litigation, stop suing each other and compete in the marketplace.
Well, then you mentioned that the biscuit ball went to Premier or somebody else in between, mm-hmm. and ultimately ended with Premier. How does the guy feel when he sees his baby get sold, not once, which he did, but twice, because then his buyer was selling again, and all this money is out there, and he's out of the picture unless he got a royalty.
Well, he started this company, he and his wife, with almost nothing. They had a small loan from his wife's father, and he, you know, it wasn't only the biscuit bouncer. He had other neat products, and it was more a matter of his creativity and entrepreneurship that allowed them to hire more employees, which allowed them to hire more employees, which allowed him to build this business. And, you know, by the time the business was at the size where it was first, it wasn't an acquisition. It was more of a merger with another company.
Mm-hmm.
And he acquired an ownership interest in the new company.
Okay.
And then that new company was then sold to another larger company. So, you know, I can promise you he was very, very happy in the outcomes of both of those transactions.
Where did he have his business location?
He was initially in Burnsville.
Okay. A neighbor, almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think most of his operations were out of Burnsville. A lot of his products were manufactured overseas. So primarily Burnsville, actually. I think that's his main office space.
We had a guy out in Castle Rock. Gee whiz, I'm going to forget the name of the business, but he built these portable, put-up-able, if there is such a word, glass greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he went to China to see if the product can be made there and all that, and mm-hmm. it's just crazy how there's a big fight between how you feel. Do you want to get this item cheaper because it's made in China, or do you want to get that item more expensive, have it be more expensive because it's made in America? And those are pretty tough choices for people that have product that are patented, I would assume.
Yeah, you know, they are. Back in the, you know, 80s, it was a much more difficult proposition for people who were having their products manufactured in China, because the intellectual property protection scheme in China at that time was virtually non-existent. So, but yeah, I mean, of course, you know, it's, I mean, we don't want to dive into a big political discussion here, but, you know, that we do exist in a global economy, and we have for very many years now. And if an entrepreneur can get a product made in China, for dramatically less than it would cost to have that product made somewhere else, you know, it's not irrational from an economic perspective to do that. You know, there's a lot of market forces today that I think, you know, change that equation depending upon what product it is that you're trying to get manufactured. You know, that there's quite a few companies who have figured out that manufacturing in the United States is actually more profitable given a lot of the circumstances that are happening in the world today. But
so you're bringing up a lot of questions for me, and I appreciate you doing this. Once again, my guest this morning is Christopher Sorensen. And Chris, when you say intellectual property, why don't you tell me and our listeners exactly what is that?
Well, sure. It's, you know, if you think about it, it's a way to protect inventions and new ideas in a way that, well, I don't know. Even saying ideas is kind of difficult, because in patent law, the ideas are actually not patentable. It's the actual embodiment of the idea that you get a patent on or a copyright on. Or so intellectual property in general it's a property interest just like your home or your yard. But it's a property interest that has to be defined in a way that's different than we define a property interest in, like, real property, you know, this lot of this section of this county. When you're defining what an invention is, you have to do it in words, and sometimes inventions can't be very well defined by the English language or really any language. So intellectual property is like an umbrella term that refers to the effort to protect a property interest in inventions or expressions or trade names. So that's what intellectual property is. It's just like what it sounds like. It's just like real physical property. It's just that it's more ethereal and more difficult to define in terms of an English language or in any language. It's a way of defining your right to exclude others from doing what it is that you've done.
I just learned a new word, ethereal.
Ethereal, yeah. So,
you know, here comes the big one. By the way, you're listening to KYMN Radio. We're out of Northfield, Minnesota, the home of Kyle's Colleges and Contentment, and it's a beautiful, sunny Thursday morning in May. And my guest this morning is Christopher Sorensen on the Wayne Eddy Affair. What about this? And boy, I bet you can talk forever about it. Knockoffs.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I don't know about too much, but like I know the name couch is a big name nowadays for women's purses, I think. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Rolex. I bought a Rolex watch in downtown Manhattan on Times Square. And I got a real deal on it. It's $25 for a Rolex watch. And containers that are coming over from China. By the way, one other thing. My era of growing up, I was born in 41. After the Second World War, America helped rebuild Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So tons of stuff were coming over from Japan, made in Japan. And the unions in America dissed that, you know, buy made in America. Well, mm-hmm. then that switched over to China. So where was I going with this? Oh, the knockoffs. The huge containers coming from China, for example, with knockoffs of property that you and I would recognize, like the Rolex watch that isn't a Rolex watch or isn't a couch purse. You ever get involved in stuff like that? And maybe talk about what that is all about.
You know, no, I haven't really been involved in that type of enforcement action. I know that the, you know, what you're describing, however, is something that is extraordinarily damaging to the United States market. Yes, you might be able to get something that says Rolex on it, and it may not, you know, it may cost $20 or whatever, but it's not a Rolex, and you know it's not a Rolex. That type of enforcement action is something that I haven't been involved in directly, but, you know, our firm, like, have you heard of Cristal Champagne?
Oh, Cristal, yeah.
Yeah, it's, and I wasn't involved, you know, one of my partners and very, very close friends was involved in this trial. It was in Minnesota, actually, a company in the United States that was selling in knockoff Cristal. They had a different letter in the word, in the name, I think, and same packaging, same look, same everything. It's a very expensive French sparkling wine. And so we were involved in that action, and we were successful in enforcing that trademark for Cristal in the United States. So, you know, it's hard to talk in the abstract about it other than to say, you know, as an attorney who has worked in this space for a very long time, defending both accused infringers as well as asserting intellectual property rights of others, that whole knockoff system is very, very, very damaging. You know, there's an analogy actually into the music industry, you know, with the advent of the, you know, online digital music distribution and all of the current market. You know, mixtapes were always really exciting and done a lot in the 80s, but, you know, when you copy somebody's music, you're really taking some money away from that artist, you know, who created it, who put that expression down on tape, and who is trying to sell that product. And, you know, there's a lot of very powerful laws in place that protect the original artists and protect the original inventors and protect the companies that trade off of the names that you've described, both Coach as well as Rolex. And those knockoffs are, in my personal opinion, terrible, terrible things. they take away jobs, they take away revenue, they take away a lot of incentive for companies to develop the next newest, neatest, most awesome product. And it makes those authentic products more expensive for everybody else.
Well, sometimes I get the impression that people purposely, obviously, do something like steal a name and put it on a product similar. And it's like, well, you know what? We're eventually going to get caught. But we are going to make a ton of money until we get caught, and we're going to hide that money. And when they give us a cease and desist and a $100,000 fine, that's fine. I'll pay it, and I'll desist, and I'll live off the $1 million I made knocking off that purse.
Yeah, you just told one variation of the story that I tell to juries and judges all the time. That happens. That's true. You know, that's why it's so important to protect your intellectual property as best as you can. I mean, sometimes in the scenario that you just described, it might cost $1 million to actually enforce and stop and get that copier off the market, which may, from a business perspective, not make any sense. And so a simple cease and desist letter, if they stop and discontinue whatever it is that they're doing, then that sometimes works. It all really depends on what you're dealing with in the marketplace.
Do you spend time in D.C.?
Yeah, that's like my second home. I spend a lot of time in D.C., yes.
Tell me why.
Our Alexandria office, which is, you know, just across the river from D.C., it's right next door to the patent office, and that's where our office is, and we spend a lot of time there with most of my pharmaceutical cases are in Delaware and in New York and in New Jersey, and I spend a lot of time then in D.C. with one of my other partners working on and developing the stories that we ultimately need to tell in those courts.
So you want to take a brief break?
If you need to, that's fine. I'm okay. I can keep going.
Okay. I know sitting in a studio for 2 hours, for some people that can be a little bit much, especially if... never mind.
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Well, we will take a break, though. We will be right back, because if you got an old car in your driveway, here's what to do.
Do you have an old junker car in the garage or on the farm? Call Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300. Get the most cash for your old junker vehicle and have it taken away for free. Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300.
Well, that was a brief break on this Thursday morning on KYMN Radio, A Friend You Can Count On. Here's another song from 1987.
I hear the ticking of the clock. I'm lying here, the room's pitch dark.
So name this tune there, young man.
Yeah. You know,
I wonder where you are tonight.
I just don't know. I see her name in her face in my mind. This is the band that did Barracuda. I'm just drawing a blank.
See where I'm pointing to?
Yeah, to your heart?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Heart. The band Heart. That's right.
It's called Alone.
Right.
26 minutes after 10 o'clock on KYMN Radio, A Friend You Can Count On. And we are talking to a fellow by the name of Christopher Sorensen. He lives right here in Northfield. He is a patent attorney. And we're chit-chatting about that. I haven't even got into your life yet, but we can get along some other day when you are. I appreciate your taking time to be here this morning. I know you're a really busy guy. But
it's my pleasure.
Are you going to be running up to the cities after this interview?
You know, by the time this interview's over, probably not. One of the nice things about my job is I can do it from pretty much anywhere.
Computer.
You know, I just need a good internet connection, and I can.
You aren't the only one that looks at their phone while I'm doing an interview. And when that first started happening, I was telling my wife. I said, you know, I'm. You know, during a brief break, they take their phone and start looking at it and using their thumbs. And she says, Wayne, people can multitask.
Yeah.
I can't.
You know, I'm actually not very good at multitasking. Like, when we're talking to each other, I'm not looking at my phone. You know, it's just on the breaks. I get the emails that come in from the teams that I'm working with, and they're asking me questions. I just need to check real quick to make sure there's nothing I need to respond to right away.
I kind of looked over your shoulder there, not over your shoulder, but it looked like you had a full screen of emails.
Yeah, I get a lot of emails.
It can be kind of a pain in the ass, right?
It can be, but it's
sure is nice. Comes in handy. Tell me about your trips to Washington, D.C. Were they overnighters? Were they 2-3 days? Did you drive out there? Did you fly out there?
I fly out there. It's usually, 3 or 4 days in the work week that we, get together. There's an attorney in D.C. that I work with a lot on building our trial theories and building our themes and doing a lot of the paperwork that we need to do. I mean, it involves a lot of strategic thinking and a lot of, it's almost like a chess game in the sense that you want to figure out where the other side wants to get to eventually and make sure that you make the moves that you need to do now to be able to adequately address, where you think the other side's going to go. And so, but my trips to D.C. are usually 3 or 4 days, sometimes 5 days, and I fly out and, spend a lot of time in Alexandria.
First class?
Oh, no.
Business coach?
No, we're in the back of the bus these days.
Oh, man. You must hate it every time you have to go there.
No, you just kind of...
The flying part.
You just get used to it. I mean, I travel a lot, and there's a lot of ways that you just, you just handle it. It's not all that different from riding the bus into Minneapolis. As long as I have something to read and something to work on, the time goes pretty quick.
So you go out there because of the patent office being in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, the patent office is in Alexandria.
But
I go out there because our office is right next to the patent office, and in our office we have a war room where we have lots of whiteboards and lots of creative thought going on. That's the kind of work that you can't do over the phone or via email. You have to be face-to-face.
Are the clients with you then?
Sometimes. Not most of the time. It's just our teams getting together, working through a problem, figuring out what the story is. We call it whiteboard sessions.
Okay.
So we have these giant whiteboards on all the walls, and we spend a lot of time in creative problem-solving mode, trying to think through how to best articulate whatever it is that the story is that we're trying to tell at the moment.
Well, it is obviously a complex deal. And I like to get the, what did they used to call those, cliff notes?
Yeah.
Remember
sure.
those?
Yeah.
I guess they got something else that's different that you use your smartphone with, I guess. I don't know. Are you from the cliff notes era?
Yeah, no, I remember cliff notes for sure. Yeah, I think now it's all online. You can get summaries of different books, all over the place now.
Amazing. It's 10:29 on 1080 Radio, and I am fortunate to have a patent attorney in the office in the studios with me, Christopher Sorensen. And I've always wanted to talk to a guy that was involved in, or a woman that was involved in the patent industry, because it's so complex, and we see it on everything that we use. Always patent pending or patent. Is patent a number then? Once you get it?
Yeah, they're a number. And, actually, I think in the next couple months, we're going to transition into the 10 million range, right? So patents started out sequentially, 1, 2, 3, 4, they're up into the upper 9,999,000. Here pretty soon, there's going to transfer into the 10 million, which, again, for all the nerds in the IP world, that's kind of an exciting milestone. But, yeah, they're just numbered sequentially, and they're referred to usually by the last three digits of the patent number.
Do you think that there may be people lining up to be that 10 millionth patent, and will the patent office have a little party?
I think that they're planning on a little party, yes. I don't think there's people lined up. It's all a matter of, these are all issuing patents off of applications that were filed, 2 or 3 or more years ago. So, you know, nobody's standing in line and waiting. Everyone's just kind of watching to see what.
So it's all been submitted already.
Yeah, these are all, you know, patent applications will stay pending for sometimes 4 or 5 years. It takes a long time to get through. Sometimes.
So when the person that gets that 10 millionth patent number, will that product or that company do anything to boldly say anything about
it? No, probably not. Okay. You know, the companies don't really care what the patent number is. It's mostly the patent office and the patent prosecutors, the attorneys that work in that space. It's just recognizing that, you know, the United States government is about to issue its 10 millionth patent. It's, you know, it's a milestone like any other, but it's completely random as to what particular company might actually get that 10 million patent number.
Okay, we heard about the biscuit ball in Mr. Man.
The biscuit bouncer.
The biscuit bouncer. Tell us about another product that you carry through from original to protected.
You know, let's see. There's been a lot of them in the sense that when a company is accused of infringement or when a company tries to assert its own patent rights, it's really a problem that needs to be solved. And so your question about a product carried through to its conclusion, you know, the ICFs, I mean, a lot of my other stories are more about defending companies being accused of infringement. So, you know, it's a little bit of a different take. I mean, there was a case, an interesting case that I worked on for a company in Minnesota, and I'm not going to remember the name. Polycarbonate polarized sunglass lenses. So these sunglass lenses are injection molded with polycarbonate, and in the injection mold machine, they put the polarizing sheet to make the sunglass polarized. And the benefit of this was that the polarizing film was protected within the polycarbonate itself, and then you could take that polycarbonate and, you know, cut it out and shape it into your prescription, your glasses prescription. There was a battle over that. And we were the patent holder in that case, and we were suing an infringer in California who was making and selling polycarbonate polarized sunglass lenses made in injection molding technology exactly like ours. I mean, they were essentially copying the technology. And in that case, it was interesting because the product was so profitable and it was making so much money in the industry at the time that the company decided to fight. And they were able to, they scoured the world and they found a published Japanese patent application from many, many years before, which qualified as prior art to our patent application that no one had seen before. And that, you know, that prior art Japanese patent publication was a really difficult challenge. We were all of a sudden on the defense. In that case, even though we own the patent and we were asserting the patent, we saw that this prior art that had never been considered by the patent office before, you shift into defense, and it was a really, really challenging case. I mean, we ended up being able to settle that case as well on terms that are confidential, but that the client was very happy about.
Well, that leads us to the next obvious question is, what do patents mean internationally?
That's really complicated. So there... a lot of the European countries around the world all have their own patent systems as well, and there's this thing called the Patent Cooperation Treaty, the PCT treaty, that allows for your patent application, if it's filed in one country, you file a PCT application that automatically files it in all of these other countries that are signatories to that agreement. So, you know, patents exist in every country in the world, more or less. I mean, there's exceptions to that. And they're very, very powerful also in other countries. You know, for the United States market, you only use a United States patent to enforce your right to exclude others from practicing that invention. But worldwide patent protection is also part of what we do, and it's also an incredibly important part of today's market because it truly is a worldwide market that we're dealing with.
So,
and you know, one interesting thing too is I was in China in December on a pharmaceutical conference, and it's really interesting to see how the Chinese government is really working towards developing their own and improving their own intellectual property system. It was really eye-opening, in fact, to see how well and how thoughtful and how hard they are actually working on improving the system within China, because I think it's becoming a pretty important aspect of the Chinese government's ability to, you know, do what it wants to do in terms of competing globally.
Which they do what they want to do.
Yeah, but, you know, they're starting to realize that it's also important to start protecting their own IP and to protect the IP of other companies that invest in China. And it's, you know, they're really working hard to change the reality of the absence of any intellectual property protection in China.
So here you are. You got a guy in Minnesota who has this way to make sunglasses. Somebody in California knocks off his idea, identical, and so now you're protecting the guy from Minnesota from the knockoff artist in California, and in all of your research, you learn that Japan had a patent on that particular way of doing things well before your client.
Yeah.
So now, you said you go into a defensive mood. What ends up happening to the guy in California? What ended up happening to your company, whom you were representing, and the Japanese original?
Well, the Japanese reference was a published application that never issued into a patent, but it was nonetheless published and in the public record. And the idea for patent protection is you have to have done something that nobody else had done before. And so the accused infringer in that case found this application that predated our applications by several years and made an argument then that our patent was invalid because somebody else had invented it. So if they had prevailed in that argument, then they would have been free to continue knocking off our client's product. At least that patent would not have been enforceable against that company.
Okay, so the California company hopscotched over you to the Chinese company and said, you know, blah, blah. Okay, now you settled, right?
Right.
Without going before a judge or a jury.
Yep.
And in a settlement like that, who is the winner? Japan? Your client or California?
Yeah, there was nobody in Japan who had an interest in the case. It was just an application
really?
That had been filed and published in Japan, and that application was being used by the California company to defend itself against my Minnesota company. So, you know, in that particular case, and what's typical is both parties get together and they realize, okay, we could lose and we could win. We could both spend a lot of money on our lawyers. We're both trying to compete in the marketplace. Let's reach an agreement where, you know, we can continue to sell our product. We'll pay you a royalty for the sales of our product. We'll honor your intellectual property rights in that way, and let's all go away, which is, you know, a very high-level way of summarizing how most of these settlements occur. You know, it's a business decision at the end of the day, and most rational economic actors tend to try, if they can, to not spend a whole lot of money on the lawyers and spend more money on developing the market and pushing the market and getting more customers for their product.
And do you think that there are companies that do this on purpose so they can get that royalty or so that they can be involved in a lawsuit and get a settlement? You know, like, hey, you know what? I'm going to infringe on that guy's idea and see what happens.
Well, I think that's too. That certainly does happen. I think it's the exception to the rule. Usually it's a competitor who has a good faith belief in their product not infringing another competitor's patent, and the competitor having a different view, a different reading of how the patent defines the property interest. And so it's really more, you know, good faith, legitimate disputes between companies over where the intellectual property interest starts and stops and whether a competitor is infringing. I mean, it's not. It's hard to think of a company who does something like a willful patent infringement on purpose just to spark a lawsuit. That doesn't happen very often. I mean, you know, most companies really do try to respect the intellectual property rights of others. It's just that there's quite often a very legitimate debate over whether a redesign is truly outside the scope of the invention or not.
You know. Do you do copyright at all?
I have done copyright cases, and I know copyright fairly well. It depends on your question.
Okay.
Because it can get complicated, too.
Well, let's talk about recipes. Let's talk about books. Let's talk about music.
Sure. So copyright is a different area where you have the ability to protect the expression of whatever it is that you're dealing with. So the expression, if unique, is protectable, and it's in some ways a protection that's less extensive than a patent, but in other ways it can be very, very powerful. So like if you write a poem, the moment you articulate that expression on paper, you, by law, have a copyright in that expression. If you want to enforce it, if you want to keep your neighbor from copying your poem and selling it to somebody else, well, you need to have filed your expression with the copyright office and gotten your copyright certificate, and then you can enforce that copyright against that company.
Are there copyright pending?
I've never seen that before. Because you technically have your copyright at the moment you create your expression, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just that you can't enforce it until after you get your copyright certification from the copyright office, and then even with that, you have to prove copyrightability, and you have to prove that the infringer actually infringes on whatever it is that your expression is. So copyright law right now is where the big wars are in is software and the copyrightability of software. So a computer code that tells a computer to do something or not do something, and the way it gets implemented when, you know, humans interact with it, that's where there's a lot of depth in copyright law, because if you have a copyright in a particular computer program and the way it operates, there are certain aspects of that program that can be copyrightable, and there are certain aspects of that program that are not copyrightable, and the battle is over the copyrightable portion of that, and then if you get that established, others can't use your copyrightable portion, nor can they make derivatives of that copyrightable portion. So copyright can be very, very broad in the context of software.
I remember the lawsuit, I can't remember, Paul McCartney and My Sweet Lord. And then there was, I think Prince was involved in one, and maybe Michael Jackson. But there's only so many bars on the music scale,
right.
So you can't call it infringement unless it's almost identical, I think. And I also was shocked to find out that you can call your song any name that you want to, just for the heck of it. Let's take Tennessee Henry Ford. You ever heard of him?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I bet if I heard some of the music, I would recognize
16
it.
Tons. You load 16
oh,
tons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
If I wanted to write a song right now and call it 16 tons, I can do that. You can use the same name. I was shocked when I found that out.
Yeah,
I'm also shocked about the time. I have to take another break.
Okay,
Chris? Thank you. All right. You're listening to KYMN Radio, a friend you can count on out of Northfield, Minnesota. We call it the Wayne Eddy Affair. I'm your host, Wayne, and my guest is Christopher Sorensen, a patent lawyer.
Millstream Commons Assisted Living is where the all-star seniors enjoy life in Northfield. From the delicious meals, the bright, spacious apartments, the volunteer projects, the bus trips we take, classes we attend, and the music we enjoy, there's something for everyone. At Millstream Commons, we treat everyone like an MVP. For more information, call 507-650-0141.
Willie's Shoe Repair in Northfield is your shoe and boot repair center. Randy also does leather repair, including bags and briefcases. They sell new boots, belts, and shoe care items. Your shoes and boots will appreciate the quality work at Willie's Shoe Repair.
Mm-hmm.
Number 10 in all of 1987, my bumper music here this morning on the Wayne Eddy Affair. And I've been kind of teasing Chris here about this, and he knows the song but doesn't know the name and the performer. Name this tune.
Yeah, same thing. I recognize it. I know what it is.
Like a warrior that fights and win the battle.
That's Aretha Franklin. I know that.
Aretha Franklin.
But then, is it George Michael?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
Knew you were waiting for me or
yes.
something? Okay.
Wow.
Got it.
Pretty good, yeah. 13 minutes before I'll make it, well, here, give the exact here. 10:46:29. There we go. All right. Before I took the break here on KYMN, I had asked if, in my head, I think I asked, have you been involved in copyright lawsuits? And
mm-hmm.
then I know your big deal is pharmaceutical. Talk about that. But what about copyright infringement or protection or suing anybody?
Yeah, you know, it was a my client was a engineering company that worked with very large surface mining machines. So in the Powder River Basin in northeast Wyoming, there's large open pit coal mines, and those coal mines run these giant shovels that, you know, take off the overburden and get down to the coal. And so my client's company had figured out a way to work with the programmable logic controllers, the computers that essentially run these giant machines, because they all have electric motors and they're all controlled with this basic PCU, and they had figured out a way to change the programming code in a way that allows the operator to measure, for instance, how much each bucket load weighs, because if they can, they know exactly the amount of material in each bucket load, they can then more accurately fill the dump trucks or the trains over the course of the day and be a lot more efficient with this giant machine. And that software was really very, very valuable because, you know, these machines are built to last sometimes for 80, 90 years. And if you can get these giant machines to operate more efficiently day to day, well, then your overall operation is more efficient and more profitable. So I was involved in a case where that client, there was an employee who left the company, and they learned that the employee had installed their software on a customer's drag line in South Florida somewhere. And so we sued the former employee, and we got the software, and sure enough, it was exactly the same. He had basically taken the software from his employer and was installing it on a customer's machine in Florida. And so the cause of action associated with that was trade secret theft as well as copyright. And the real battle came down to whether the programming code used on that programmable logic controller was copyrightable subject matter. And that was a lawsuit actually in Wyoming, which was fun because I got to go back to Wyoming. It was in Cheyenne. And we impaneled the jury. We did opening statements. We were just about to finish up with the first witness, and the case settled because the former employee realized that, he realized that he probably needed to.
You had him by the.
We had him over the barrel.
thank you. That's even better.
Right.
I won't say who it is, but I can remember somebody telling me that he got a program, and I'm speaking in knowledgeable terms now, that he was able to download at no cost. He got the program from a company that was selling it, but he got it at no cost by manipulating his computer.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea at the time what he was talking about. This is like 20 years ago. I'm thinking hardware, and he's talking about software. And what's software? At that time, I mean, I didn't even know what a floppy disk was when we got him in the office. But now I get it. It's intellectual theft by way of computer.
Right.
We have a final break. And then when we come back, there's a lot of people listening right now that would like to hear about pharmaceuticals Because most recently in the news, it's been reported that companies pull shenanigans with within their corporation that buys up a company at, you know, $50 a pill, and now it's $5,000 a pill. Or the vials that were at $79.95 are now $795 or $7,009. And it's just crazy. And you're in that business, so we'll find out about that, folks. But first, we're going to hear from a couple of folks that I do appreciate.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Spring is officially here. Mother's Day and prom are both this weekend, and Judy's Floral Design on Division Street across from the middle school is ready. Judy's Floral Design has an array of marvelous flowers to pick from. Or browse judysfreshfloraldesign.com for a large selection of arrangements and price ranges. Happy Mother's Day. And remember, no matter if it's prom or mom, Judy's Florals is ready for flowers to become a part of your day.
Yeah, this is George Michael's Faith.
Yep, you got it.
Yeah.
Quite a hook on this song, huh?
Yeah.
I always like to go, ladies and gentlemen, we're gathered here today to listen to The Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN, a friend you can count on. All right, let's have a little faith here at 7 minutes before 11 o'clock. Well, Mr. Christopher Sorensen, tell me about, you work with pharmaceutical companies, and they have a bad glow right now by way of undercover reporting from networks.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm happy to say that my work is representing generic pharmaceutical companies who bring prescription drug products to the United States market faster and for less cost than the brand companies. So, you know, I know there's a lot of debate either way, but I feel like I'm on the right side of this battle, in that we try. So the way it works is, you know, if you have a brand pharmaceutical, an ANDA application can be filed, which is an abbreviated new drug application by a generic company to get approval to market the product that they want to market as a generic version of a brand. And the generic company just needs to prove bioequivalence. They don't have to go through the same safety studies and the same development that the brand does. And when that application is filed, there is also a parallel lawsuit that occurs where the brand company sues the generic company to figure out whether the generic product will infringe the brand company's patents that apply to the brand product. So what I do is we represent the generic companies trying to establish that we're not infringing the brand company's patents, or if there is infringement of the brand company's patents, those patents are invalid for one reason or another. So,
running out of time?
Sure.
Okay. But other than that, if it's a generic pill from an established pill by name, it has to have the same ingredients, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It has to have exactly the same active ingredient.
Okay, so then, therefore, they would be infringing on the named pill, unless time ran out.
Well,
That's just my logic.
Yeah. So the active ingredient is the small molecule that actually treats the disease state. And the brand companies rightfully have, if there's a patent on that active ingredient, then they rightfully should have their market exclusivity for the life of that patent. That's what the whole patent system's about. And it is very important to have that incentive in place. Otherwise, it's very hard to conceive of a pharmaceutical company doing all the work that's necessary to establish and develop and discover these new drugs. I mean, that's good for everybody.
R&D.
Where things get mixed up is once that central small molecule has reached the end of its patent life, the brand companies have really mastered the art of, it's called evergreening. So they'll have exactly the same active ingredient, but they'll put it in a delayed release form. So a form that it, once you swallow it, it slowly goes into your blood system rather than immediately. And they'll say that that delayed released formulation has benefits over the immediate release formulation for some reason or another. It's that area where they try to extend out that patent life where all these battles happen for the generic companies, because sometimes it is inventive, but sometimes it's not inventive to simply change the form of the tablet that's being used to deliver the small molecule ingredient that treats the disease state.
So the generic people are trying to save the consumer money ultimately, but they have this huge amount of people that have to they have to go through before they can give it to the public, and that you know, obviously R&D, obviously manufacturing, and then an anticipated and budgeted in lawyer fees, because they know they're going to get involved in a lawsuit one way or the other.
Right. The process allows for the lawsuit to happen at the same time the FDA's review is happening. So that's how it works in the United States. That's how you get generic drugs on the market sooner than they otherwise would. Before this system was in place, the generic company couldn't even file with the FDA until after the FDA's exclusivity expired. And preparing the ANDA application or preparing the generic form would sometimes be deemed a patent infringement in and of itself. So it took a lot longer for generic products to actually get on the market. Yeah. It's called the Hatch-Waxman Act. And the Hatch-Waxman Act essentially allows for the patent litigation to happen at the same time the FDA review is happening, so that if everything gets cleared in the patent litigation and the FDA approves it, that generic comes on the market a lot faster than it would have otherwise come onto the market.
Question. Do you know what 60 Minutes and KYMN Radio have in common?
I do not.
They were both started in 1968.
Oh, okay.
Speaking about 60 Minutes, they had we only have 2 minutes left, so maybe some other time, but a company made a product and another company made a similar product. So company A bought company B so there wouldn't be a competition. And then company A now manufactured the pill 5,000 times more than company B had been charging. And what a way to screw people and sick people.
Yeah, I think that's been getting a lot of news lately, and that's a very unfortunate circumstance. And, you know, that is those types of situations are called orphan drugs, because they are drugs that are that treat a very small population of people. And a lot of pharmaceutical companies, both brand and generic, will find that it just doesn't make any sense to be investing in manufacturing that particular product. So over the years, it'll consolidate down to only maybe one supplier that has approval. And then that one supplier realizes they're the only supplier. They can charge whatever they want because there's not that competition.
Yeah, and then, of course, Medicaid gets involved and insurance companies get involved, hospitals get involved, pharmacies get involved. And who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy on the whole deal? And that's another debate. Will you please join me again sometime, and we'll do you when you were born in Gillette, Wyoming,
sure.
And what it was like growing up. Did you live in town, or did you live outside of a community in Gillette?
Both my parents were teachers, so I lived in town, but the ranch was 30 miles north that my grandfather lived on, and I spent my summers and weekends and evenings working on the ranch north of town.
You sing that song a lot? Home, home on the ranch?
No.
Okay.
I know it, though.
Well, so you'll agree to come back?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. I know I really will enjoy it, and we'll just get in. You're a very pleasant interview.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Christopher Sorensen, my guest on 1080 AM I almost said stereo, but we're not stereo anymore. KYMN Radio, AM 1080 from Northfield, Minnesota. And, of course, now the 1, 95.1 FM. I will reiterate that.
95.1, the 1.
Well, don't walk out on me. Why can't we get along? I know you're gone. I wish you'd come home. Don't leave me here. Don't leave me alone. I know you're gone. Down, roll over and die.